Okay, so today we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to be getting involved in the biggest piece of gossip, slander, some might say libel about me that took place in the last 6 months while I was away. We are going to discuss Rory Stewart, his attacks on me, and we're going to be answering the question, who is allowed to talk about economics? Okay, so I'm going to provide just the most basic context for people who are maybe don't know the rest is politics, don't know Rory Stewart, or are not from this country. The Rest is Politics is probably the biggest politics podcast in the UK. It is hosted by two centrist political figures, a former Conservative MP called Rory Stewart, and a former Labour strategy advisor under Tony Blair, Alistair Campbell. And they interviewed Zach Polanski, who is the new sort of resurgent leader of the Greens last year in November. And I became a subject of the conversation. And I'm going to watch, well, I'm going to show you the what was said about me back then so you can see for yourself.
Tell us which economists you're listening to. Who are your intellectual influences here?
Brilliant people. So Grace Blakely, Richard Murphy, who's been doing a lot of work on this, Gary Stevenson, who I know you've had on recently, James Medway or James Meadway, lots of different economists, though. A lot of the time it's just reading the stuff that they're talking about. And I think there is a consensus that the neoliberal model has broken and it's not worked.
Consensus where? From people like Gary Stevenson? Or where's the consensus? Where's the academic consensus here?
I think the academic consensus is among economists who aren't working for the government. I think they're all looking at
And
government
you see Gary
decisions.
Stevenson as a sort of pseudo-academic economist or a...
I don't think he's pseudo-academic. I think he's literally an economist. That's his job.
What about you mentioned...
it's not his job. He's a city trader. He studied an undergraduate degree in economics.
Right.
Okay, he's not a professional economist.
But I think if you do a degree in economics, it's fair to say you're
okay.
an economist.
Where are the people with graduate level degrees in economics that you're focusing on here? Where are the professors? Where are the people who for whom this is their academic speciality?
So this underlines.
Okay, so that is Rory Stewart, pretty publicly denying my credibility as an economist and disappearing my postgraduate degree at Oxford. It's pretty scandalous, really. People who've followed this channel for a long time will be aware that it is not uncommon for me to be attacked in the press. I have been attacked pretty publicly on YouTube before,
Skinny little dip.
And in the newspapers. And in general, I have like a strategy which is like I just don't engage with nonsense on the internet, nonsense in the newspapers, and I wasn't going to engage in this one. But I think something happened when I was filming the documentary for Channel 4. So for people who don't know, I've been filming a documentary for Channel 4, which will come out in the next couple of months, and I was filming that in the last few months of last year. And this incident was released while I was filming that documentary. And I remember I was in a car driving back from somewhere doing an interview with probably somebody horrible. And somebody messaged me on my WhatsApp saying, "Oh, have you seen this? Rory Stewart talking about you on The Rest Is Politics." And I had a look at it. And I thought, as soon as I saw it, I thought it was really interesting. And I'll tell you why. So I get attacked a lot in the media, you know. The Daily Mail ran four attack pieces on me in four consecutive days last year. They knocked on my parents' house. They went through my mum's Facebook. The Financial Times wrote a 5,000-word hit piece on me. And I don't enjoy those kinds of things, but I've come to expect it. But what was really interesting about this attack by Rory Stewart was most instantly how easily this provable it was. So the big attack, which sort of my former colleagues like to come at me with, is Gary was not the best trader at Citibank. It's a very popular attack line from them. And it's smart. The reason it's smart is because it's obviously impossible for me to prove I was the best trader at Citibank. There's no like certificate you can bring out. And if you're going to attack somebody and say somebody's a liar, it makes sense to attack them in a way that they cannot immediately disprove. But Rory Stewart came out and implied that I don't have any qualifications in economics, which is incredibly easily disprovable. And I posted a tweet immediately saying, look, here is my degree. You know, you get a certificate for it, you can show it. Here is my master's degree from Oxford. And it was, as soon as it came up, it was in my sort of high school WhatsApp chat. I said to them, you know, this, we will get a public apology from this guy because, quite simply, because otherwise, like, it's a legal risk, right? You cannot lie about the qualifications of probably your biggest commercial rival publicly. Like, it's, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I would imagine you can't get away with that. So I told them we'd get an apology, and we did get an apology. And I was going to leave it at that. But then while I was filming the documentary, I started to notice a sort of a trend happening, which was, so I've never had any negative interactions with the public, which is amazing. I get attacked online all the time. But I had one negative interaction while I was filming the documentary, which was I was filming outside the Treasury here in the centre of London. And a guy came out of the Treasury, sort of a middle-aged guy in his sort of, I guess, late 40s. And he came up to me and he sort of took me by the arm in quite like a tender way. And he came close to me and he said into my ear, I just want you to know, you're completely economically illiterate. And this is a guy who worked in the Treasury. And then over the course of interviewing some different people, especially people like sort of from this sort of intellectual elite, I started to realise a kind of narrative, a new narrative was forming on this global battle against inequality, global battle for wealth taxes, global battle to improve the economy. A new sort of very simplistic narrative was forming, especially from these kind of elites, which is basically Gary is an idiot, Zach Polansky is an idiot, don't listen to them because they're not economists, basically. And that made me realise that this sort of new stance represented here by Rory Stewart versus politics, which is just to basically say, you know, what you would call an ad hominem attack, which is just to go after the main faces of the movement, which at the moment in this country are me and now Zach Polansky, and say, they're stupid, don't listen to them, they've not got credentials, they've not got qualifications, has basically become the core of the movement. And I think by discussing this incident, we can learn so much about the state of economics today, about politics, about the media, and really where we are at the moment in the global battle to stop inequality from increasing. And I think it teaches us really how we need to act strategically. So, you know, there's a couple of issues to deal with here. The first one is the basic accusation of, you know, Gary is not an economist. Who is an economist? And the second one is the broader implication that basically economists do not support wealth taxes. So let's start with the first one and let's answer, who is an economist? Who is allowed to talk about economics? So let's talk a little bit about economics. Now, economics is one of these specific degrees, I guess similar to maybe law or computer science or medicine or dentistry, where there is a broad perception, or engineering perhaps, there is a broad perception that these are the degrees that you take if you want to get a well-paid job. So economics has this perception that it is a pathway into well-paid jobs. And what that means is when you take economics as an undergrad, a lot of the students there, from my experience, I would say the majority of the students are not there because they are interested in economics. They are there primarily because they want to get a good job. If you go to one of these very elite universities, and I went to the London School of Economics, what you will find is the course is generally incredibly not representative in terms of social class. So I was at LSE, and really the vast majority of the people that I studied with, their parents would be at least millionaires, probably multi-millionaires, in many cases very, very wealthy people. And they are there primarily to get a good job. So when you're studying economics, it is an incredibly mathematized discipline. You spend basically 3 years in your undergrad, mainly really doing a variety of different kinds of maths, of algebra, of calculus, all of these different kinds of complicated maths. And then you basically go and try and get a job. And because the vast majority of people who have taken economics are taking it because they want to get a well-paid job, the focus for most of these students, rather than really understanding economics, is getting a good job. And when I was at university, and I suspect probably still now, basically the best paid job you could get from economics, doing economics, was to work as a trader. I graduated in 2008. I was trying to get a job in sort of 2006, I would say, 2007. And all the best students, in terms of the students with the best grades, wanted to be traders. I suspect this probably changed a little bit over the years. I guess nowadays you probably do get some economic students wanting to go into other fields, like maybe AI or like maybe some of these big tech jobs. But I would guess still the majority of students want to go into trading. Really, this question, which Rory Stewart has brought up of, is Gary a real economist? It can be narrowed down into like one incredibly simple concept, which is there is an academic track and there is an applied track. And when you do economics at an elite university, in my experience, I suspect very much still now, the vast majority of the students with the best grades are not trying to go towards the academic track, for the very simple reason that the academic track of economics is, on average, much, much, much less well paid than the career track, which is going to finance. So if you want to become an academic in economics, you will need to do your 3-year undergrad. You will need to do your master's, 1 or 2 year master's. Then you'll need to do your PhD, which is probably another 3 years, maybe longer in the US. Then you need to do postdoc work and you need to do more research work. And you hope to become a professor maybe into your 30s, by which time you will be hundreds of thousands of pounds in debt. And you might start hoping to make money sometime in your 30s. Whereas I went into trading in my early 20s and I was a millionaire at 25 and a multimillionaire at 26. Basically, there is no comparison between these two tracks in terms of financial outcomes. So going on the career track, the applied track, as I've called it here, is just much, much, much more financially lucrative than the academic track. So the reality of economics nowadays is that the vast majority of the students come in trying to get a well-paid job. There is enormous competition to get the best paid jobs, and the vast majority of the students with the best grades go to work in trading. You know, this is the truth of the matter. That's not to say that some good guys do not stay and go into academia, but you have to recognise that anyone who has the grades to go into finance and chooses to stay in academia is giving up millions of pounds to do that. And the reality of it is, not many people are going to do that unless they come from richer backgrounds. And listen, there are a lot of academic economists who I have a huge amount of time for and a huge amount of respect for. We had the incredibly prestigious Korean economist Ha-Joon Chang on this channel last year. There are a couple of French economists that I really, really like, one of whom at least we're going to try to get on this year, Gabriel Zucman and Thomas Piketty. So there are great guys in academia. But the reality of the situation is the vast majority of the best students in terms of the best grades at the most prestigious universities are not trying to become academics. They are trying to become, in the large case, traders. And the best paid 10,000 economists in the world, in terms of people who are doing economics day to day, are almost certainly traders. So I think to sit there and then say, listen, I don't want to listen to the opinion of any traders, it's like a little bit absurd. You know, it's a little bit like saying you have like Cristiano Ronaldo comes on your podcast and gives his opinions on football. And you say, but you know, have you got a PhD in football? And Cristiano Ronaldo says, no, I don't. He's like, well, where are the people with the PhDs? You know, but the truth is, in many ways, I know that sounds like an absurd example, but economics is, in many ways, similar to football in the sense of the vast majority of people who are good at it when they are young are not trying to become academics. They are trying to become people who perform it in the field. You know, and obviously it's a little bit of an extreme example, but this is the case. You know, there are some disciplines where the vast majority of students are trying to become professors in that field. Economics is not one of those disciplines. The vast majority of people who study economics are trying to get jobs in finance. And the most prestigious and the most well-paid job in finance is as a trader. But when I heard this news, the first thing obviously I did is I went on Wikipedia and I looked up, what's Rory Stewart's postgraduate degree? And he doesn't have one. But the thing is, Rory Stewart accepted a professorship at Harvard. So Rory Stewart has been a Harvard professor, and I think now more recently, I'm just taking this from his Wikipedia, a Yale professor. So here you have somebody with no postgraduate degrees. So, and you know, he worked for government, you know, so he's obviously have experience in his job. If you are somebody who has no postgraduate degree and accepts a professorship at Harvard, so accepts the idea that you are now an academic expert on your subject, despite never having done a postgraduate degree, how can you then turn around to somebody who has a postgraduate degree but also has extreme levels of success in work and then say your views are invalid? Like, it's honestly, you have to say, this is tremendously hypocritical. If you are somebody who believes that people without postgraduate degrees should not express opinions on the fields in which they have worked for 20 years, you cannot accept a professorship at Harvard based upon the fact that you have experience in work. You cannot have it both ways. Either you believe, and I want to make it clear, to be honest, I don't think postgraduate degrees are that useful, right? So in economics, so I have spent 5 years at elite universities. As much as I have great respect for some of these economists who I've mentioned, and I think they would probably agree with me, the experience of studying economics at university, including at a postgraduate level, is incredibly, incredibly, incredibly depressing. You know, at Oxford, I was on a course with 77 people, all of them incredibly smart people, and they basically locked us in windowless rooms for 2 years and told us to do simultaneous equations. And that is basically what happened. So when I left the London School of Economics to go to work as a trader, there's a little story in my book. Obviously, like most trained university economists, I thought I could use what I learned at university to sort of help me be a good trader. And I started as a trader in 2008, and I made it, you know, there was a big financial crisis. My first year, I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just copying people around me. And I made my first big loss as a trader in 2010. And I lost $8 million in a week. And my P&L, my profit and loss, went from plus $4 million for the year to negative $4 million for the year. I was really stressed. And I instinctively did this thing of I went back to the books. And I started to bring my economics, it's funny looking back, I started to bring my economics textbooks onto the trading floor. And when I had a bit of free time, I would sit there and try and read, try and understand what was happening, try and understand what I lost money on. And I was tremendously lucky that I worked with one of the smartest people I've ever met, and he must be the best trader I've ever met. And he, I can't use his real name because he's in the book, but in the book it's called Billy. And he was from a working class background, he didn't go to university, and he worked his way up over the course of 20, 25 years from being a cashier at Halifax to being one of Citibank's, well, not one, of being Citibank's best trader, the best trader I've ever met, incredibly profitable trader. And he really looked after me, and he saw me reading my textbooks on the trading floor. And he let me do it for a couple of days, and then I could see he was kind of getting a bit pissed off. And one day he just stood up, he slapped this textbook out of my hand, it fell into the bin fell over. And he just looked at me and he said, "What the f*** are you doing, right? How old are you? You know, look around you. You're here with the big boys now. You're betting on what's happening in the real world. You've lost $8 million and the answer is not going to be there in your textbooks. If you want to know what is happening, you need to go out there in the real world. You need to go home and ask your mum about her financial situation. You know, you need to look at what's being advertised on the tube. You know, walk up and down your local high street. What shops are opening? What shops are closing? Are there more homeless people? Are there less homeless people? Talk to your friends and your friends' families about their financial situation. If you want to understand what's really happening in the real world, you need to get out of the books and you need to get into the real world." And this guy, so there's been a lot of controversy, obviously, about whether I was Citibank's top trader. I was Citibank's most profitable trader in 2011. This guy, Billy, was Citibank's most profitable trader every single other year I was at the bank. And he never, ever went to university. And this guy correctly predicted before it happened the 2008 financial crisis. He correctly predicted the weak recovery of the 2008 financial crisis. All of these things, which were none of the rest of us, who are all sort of elite university educated economists, none of us predicted it, but he predicted it. And later on in my career, I moved from London to Tokyo, and I was working on the Tokyo trading floor with and this guy Billy wasn't there. And another trader asked me, who do you think is the best economist at Citibank? And immediately, without hesitation, I said Billy, because he obviously was the best economist, right? You know, this guy predicted the 2008 financial crisis. He predicted the recovery. You know, he was, you know, I consider him to be one of the best economists, as well as one of the best traders I've ever met. And this trader who asked me, he started laughing and he replied, Billy's not an economist. You know, and his answer was based on the fact that Billy didn't go to university, Billy didn't have an economics degree, but Billy is making bets every single year based on his understanding of the economy, and he's out-predicting everyone. But, you know, I think this really, if I'm totally honest, I think this idea that Gary is not an economist is exactly the same as this idea in the book which I encountered as a kid, which is Billy is not an economist. I don't think there's really much more behind that other than really a kind of snobbish elitism. You know, I think if Rory Stewart thinks I'm not an economist, he has to give back the money for those professorships. Because how can you claim to be a Harvard professor level expert with no postgraduate degrees if you have publicly stated that nobody without a postgraduate degree can consider themselves an expert in their discipline? I think it's as simple as that. Like, do you or do you not believe that somebody can become an expert on a thing by working in that field? You know, are the bricklayers an expert in bricklaying because they don't have PhDs? You know what I mean? Are the hairdressers experts in hairdressing? This is a very, very simple idea, Rory Stewart. It is possible to learn about a thing by doing the thing. You do not own knowledge in your ivory towers. This is, you know, humans who do not go to university are still capable of being intelligent. And let's be quite simple and plain here. If Rory Stewart says that nobody without a PhD is an expert in their field, then he is saying every single one of you who has done your job for 10, 15, 20 years is an idiot. It's the truth. What do you want me to say? It's the truth. It's the worst kind of elitism. It's the worst kind of elitism. But listen, I'm getting upset here, but the truth is that I've had to deal with this my whole life. My whole life. I got expelled from school when I was 16, and I had to go to a new school, and straight away, oh, you didn't really write your essays. It's plagiarised. My whole life, I've had to deal with people saying, somebody who looks like you, somebody who sounds like you, is not an expert in what you do and the things that you produce. And I knew it. When I wrote my book, I knew people would say it, and I know people still do say it. He didn't really write the book. I know that's what he said. And I know people constantly say, oh, he wasn't really the best trader. This is, and I just have to tell myself, listen, if you're so good that people constantly have to say you didn't really do it, you're not really an expert, then you're probably good at what you do. All right, so listen, that's the first thing, whether you're really an economist. In my opinion, people who have incredibly good track records in their field of work are allowed to be able to claim to be experts in their field of work. And to be honest, I think Rory Stewart is a politician, despite not having any postgraduate degrees. It's in my opinion, if you have, basically, professional experience is valid. And if you don't believe that, well, you better get back to a good university, because otherwise you're not allowed to speak. All right, so we're going to get to the meat of the argument, which was, once we get past the ad hominem personal stuff, which in my opinion was a little bit stupid, there is a more substantive economic attack there, which is elite economists, like top-level economists, do not have a consensus that we want things like wealth taxes. So we're going to get to that next. But I think first, we do need, in order for us to be able to discuss this, to have a little bit of context on the space in which this attack is happening. So first thing to say is, wealth taxes are relatively new in terms of how important they are in the political discourse. So wealth taxes have been around for a long time. They've got them even now. Today they've got them in Switzerland, they've got them in Norway, they've got them in Spain. Apparently we're going to have them in Hungary now because the new government in Hungary is supportive of a wealth tax. The ideas have been around for a long time. But in the last couple of years, they have massively increased in their salience in the discourse. So salience is this term which I've been, you know, trying to push on this channel. Salience is basically how much a thing is spoken about in the media. And a big part of the aim of this channel is to increase the salience of wealth taxes and inequality in terms of how they affect living standards and the economy. And I'll be honest, I think we've been incredibly successful about that. And wealth taxes and inequality are spoken about much, much, much more in the media. And that has been happening here in the UK and across the world over the last couple of years, not just down to me. There's been great work by the guys at Patriotic Millionaires and Tax Justice UK. People like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren in the US have been speaking about it for a long time. You know, I went and spoke to Chloe Swarbrick in New Zealand, who's been speaking about it. But really, a big part of it is we have massively, here on this channel, massively increased the salience of wealth taxes and inequality in the media. But for a long time, that was largely all we had achieved. We had significantly increased the media salience, but we never won over the Conservative Party, who were in government here for 14 years. The Labour Party also haven't been won over, they're not doing it. So as much as the public wanted it, and it became an incredibly desirable public policy, because none of the realistic political parties in our two-party system were picking it up, it was basically never going to happen. Last year, that changed, and that change has to be credited, is down almost entirely to the fantastic work of the new leader of the Greens, Zach Polanski. So the Greens have had wealth taxes in their manifesto for a while. They had wealth taxes in the manifesto in 2024, the election 2 years ago, but they didn't really talk about it that much. And when Zach Polanski came in, he started to talk much, much more about inequality, much, much more about wealth taxes. He did a incredibly energetic social media campaign, which included making videos and appearing on loads and loads and loads of different podcasts. And to be honest, I was incredibly impressed. I think the work he did was fantastic. The amount of work he did was fantastic. Talking about wealth taxes. And that led to an enormous increase in the Greens in the polls. And the Greens, who have always historically been a small slash very small British party, which have never had any significant power or influence in British politics, suddenly were polling, in many cases, second. Or I think there was a poll even last week where they were polling first. But, you know, we had polls in which the Greens were above Labour and above the Conservatives, and that's still happening. So this is the context of the when this interview took place. The Greens are massively resurgent. Wealth taxes are massively resurgent. And as much as we probably won't have an election in this country for another 3 years, at the time of the interview, 3.5 years, it was seeming increasingly possible, and it is increasingly possible, that the Greens would or could still get into government, and that Zach Polanski would become possibly even prime minister, or at least taking part in some sort of coalition government. So, and you know, we also have the context of this podcast sort of likes to set itself as like two opposite sides of the political spectrum in the two-party politics, which is one guy Labour, one guy Conservative. But we have this context of both of these parties collapsing in popularity, falling down to third and fourth in the polls, and being basically replaced by two new parties. So it's an incredibly threatening moment for these two representatives of the political establishment, but it is also a threatening moment on basically the elites of the country. You know, at the moment, we have growing and increasing inequality, and we are also seeing a society which is becoming increasingly less socially mobile. If you go to the elite universities, what you find is a lot of rich, wealthy people. If you go into elite jobs, what you find is a lot of rich, wealthy people, people whose dads were rich, people whose granddads were rich. And what that means is, as we have low social mobility and we have wealth which is largely inherited rather than earned, from the perspective of an ordinary person, what that means is, it's hard for me to make money, it's hard for me to buy a house, it's hard for me to get a good education, it's hard for me to get a good job. But from the perspective of a very elite person, a very wealthy person, it means the opposite. It means it's very easy for me to get a good house, it's very easy for me to get a good job, it's very easy for me to get a good education, it's very easy for me to stay at the top. Low social mobility means poor people stay poor and rich people stay rich. So this is like a great setup basically for the rich. So, you know, obviously when I saw like Rory Stewart coming in very aggressively. So the rest of this interview, which we've not shown, in my opinion, was a very aggressive attack by Rory Stewart on Zach Polanski, using a method which I have to be honest, I think is a little bit cheap, which is he basically sort of pinned Zach down and said, can you tell me exactly how large the UK government debt or deficit, one of these numbers is? Like, tell me the number, which is, I've got to be honest, I think incredibly cheap journalism to basically say, you know, have you memorized this number before you came on this show? Listen, we can all look that number up. We can all Google that number. Zach Polanski is not an economist. You know, if you want to do that, you should have done it to me when I went on the show. I was on the show a couple of months earlier. But what I saw when I watched that was, I think, an incredibly aggressive attack. So obviously, the first thing I wanted to do was, I want to understand, is this guy part of a very wealthy family? I don't know Rory Stewart's family background, but I just did the most basic research. I went on his Wikipedia, and the first thing I wanted to see was, is your dad's name blue and underlined? I've got to be honest, like that's the first thing I want to see nowadays, right? And I've got to be honest, that was a long article. It's got about 10 sections there, and, you know, apparently he was educated in a castle and was, according to Wikipedia, one of the most powerful men in the secret services of the country. Once we recognise this as an attack, what it is, that doesn't mean in and of itself the attack is bad. And I think when we view the meat of the attack is that, listen, economists in general, academic economists in general, do not agree with this idea that wealth taxes are good, that wealth taxes are needed. There is no consensus for this. And that attack in itself is partially true. And I want to be clear, I've been very, very clear about that from the beginning of this channel, right? If it was true that there was a consensus among academic economists that we needed to reduce inequality and we needed to do wealth taxes, then there would be no need for me to do this channel. There would have been no need for me to have left trading. And quite frankly, I wouldn't be a multimillionaire, right? The reason that I was attracted to this idea about wealth taxes, about inequality, was specifically for the reason that I recognised this important fact was missing from the broad academic economic consensus. You know, if you want to know sort of the history, we've done some videos about it, or you can read it in my book, The Trading Game, available in all good stores. I developed these ideas in the context of being a graduate of in economics, a graduate of the London School of Economics, and then working on the trading floor and witnessing a consistent series of really strong failures to predict the broad economy. So I studied my undergrad 2005 to 2008, and then I start working as a trader in the middle of 2008. There's a massive financial crisis, which nobody predicted. But then what was more interesting to me was the aftermath of the crisis was also incredibly badly predicted. And in 2008, an aggressive recovery was predicted for 2009. In 2009, an aggressive recovery was predicted for 2010. In 2010, an aggressive recovery was predicted for 2011. And at the beginning of 2011, we were still seeing massive aggressive recoveries predicted. And I was working full-time all that time in the field of predicting interest rates. And you know, interest rates are broadly linked to the strength of the economy, so everybody thought interest rates would come back up, and they never did. And I was sitting there, 2008, 2009, 2010, the beginning of 2011, realizing, like, damn, like, we are really consistently wrong on, like, this really, really big issue, which is basically, like, is the economy going to get better? Is your life going to get better? Like, year after year after year after year. And it was in that, I would like to add, you know, that wasn't just 08 to 11. You know, this constant prediction that things will get better next year lasted all the way to 2020. And if you look at the prediction of interest rates, which is broadly connected to the prediction of the strength of the economy, they predicted things would get better every single year for 13 years. And it was only in 2020, in the middle of COVID, when economists suddenly started saying, oh no, actually, interest rates will stay zero forever. And that's immediately before interest rates went to 6%. So, you know, when I was there for 3 years, what I saw was this phenomenal bad track record of predicting. And that phenomenal bad track record of predicting has continued to this day. And what you see is continual, in basically every field, continual over-optimistic prediction of the economy. For me, as somebody who has been at the elite universities and then watched the predictions, what I see is like this phenomenal track record of making bad predictions again and again and again. And I think, you know, the scientific thing to do when you see that your predictions are incredibly consistently wrong, incredibly consistently bad, is to look at your beliefs and look at your model for understanding the world and try to understand what is missing in the model. And I think that this is the logical thing to do here, and that's what I did back in 2011. I came to the conclusion that I still believe that what is missing is the significance of the importance of the wealth distribution and increasing inequality on living standards, on the macroeconomy. And betting on this has made me millions and millions of pounds back in 2011 and 2012, but also since COVID, incredibly good track record of prediction. I think it works incredibly well. But I think there is a strong case to be made that in an economy where living standards are continually worsening and expert academic predictions are continually wrong, I think there should be space to have a debate that says maybe there is something wrong with the broad economic consensus. But Rory Stewart's philosophical position seems to be anyone who says anything that goes against the broad economic consensus should not be listened to. This, to me, is incredibly worrying. You know, I think if you are in a situation where, you know, if this is like every single time a patient goes to a doctor, they're dying, right? Every single one, anyone goes to a doctor, they die. And then somebody says, hey, like maybe we should have a look at what the guys and doctors are doing in the hospital. Maybe they're doing something wrong. And Rory Stewart turns around and says, hey, are you a doctor? You know, this is incredible amount of, to be honest, like, it's incredibly hubristic intellectual gatekeeping. This idea that me and my people, I know we've been wrong for 20 years, and I know you've been right for 15 years, but do you have the certificate? You know, if you don't, off. But the thing is, you know, I actually did what surely Rory Stewart would have recommended that I do, which is I quit my job, I was making millions of pounds a year, and I went back into academia, right? So I went back into academia, and I did a two-year master's, which is like a kind of, it's called an MPhil at Oxford. It's like a special, like big master's. So it's not a PhD, but it's bigger than a master's. I started that in 2017. And, you know, obviously I was particularly interested in this one idea that I had, which is inequality is not being talked about enough. And that's making our predictions wrong. And it's making living standards fall. And in particular, I was interested in its effect on interest rates because that was what I traded. And that was what I consider myself to be a legitimate expert in. And interest rates are something which is discussed extensively in academia. And they were brought up in one of our first lectures in my master's at Oxford. And I waited behind after that lecture and I spoke to the professor. And I said to him, hey, like, can we talk about why our predictions, like broad economists, our predictions for interest rates have been so bad for so long? And he wasn't aware of the bad track record of prediction of interest rates. He was like, oh, what are you talking about? I was like, well, you know, we always said that rates were going to come back up very quickly. But by this time, 2017, rates had stayed zero for 9 years. And he turned around to me and he said, oh, like, no, we always knew rates were going to stay zero, which is like incredibly categorically provably wrong. And I was quite like surprised that here is this Oxford professor teaching interest rates at Oxford University, who is unaware that interest rates have been mispredicted for 9 years. I've got to be honest, like, I was quite shocked. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to go home and I'm going to send you the data and you're going to see that your predictions have been wrong for 9 years. And I went and I sent him the data and he was like, oh, you're right. Yeah, our predictions have been wrong for 9 years. And that was it. He didn't want to talk anymore about it. He wasn't it. And this was like, it's mind blowing to me. You know, I just want to be clear. You can go watch the article of Restless Politics. I told Rory Stewart this story on the Restless Politics, right? So, you know, I am somebody who was in academia, left academia, had an enormous amount of success. I was one of the top students there. I got my first in 2 years, right? I spent the third year just getting drunk because my grades were so good, basically. left academia, went into the city, had an enormous amount of success, came back into academia, and I've got to be honest, what I saw in academia, I cannot describe to you how dreadfully bad it was. How dreadfully, dreadfully, dreadfully bad it was. All right, but let's push back even further, because I think it's actually giving too much credit to this argument to say that there is not a consensus. Because whilst it is true that there is not a broad economic consensus on inequality and wealth taxes, there are some excellent, some of the most prestigious economists in the world that are incredibly passionate about this issue, right? So the most obvious of which is Thomas Piketty. Thomas Piketty, whose book I've got, it's wrapped in this lovely way because I bought it in Japan just after it came out. Thomas Piketty. So this guy, Thomas Piketty, he won the French Economics Association's award for the best thesis of the year in 1993. He was the 2002 best young economist in France, one of the most prestigious economists in the world. And what does he work on all the time? What does he talk about all the time? Inequality. Gabriel Zucman, who won the French Economic Association's award for the best dissertation in 2014, what does he work on? What is he passionate about? Inequality. So I just think this idea that no economists support it is just wrong. It's as simple as that, right? So, I mean, I don't know, what, really, when you dig behind the substance here, what you have is an incredibly elitist stance that is also, like, quite simply, wrong. Like, lots of elite economists are incredibly passionate about this, even ones who haven't done such grubby, mucky work as trying to make actual money as a professional trader. And what I see here when I see people push back on this, really, is you have, in my opinion, unfortunately, a tremendously out-of-touch elite class that is incredibly unwilling to accept the, I would say, like, increasingly obvious truth that living standards are falling and things have to change. So I spoke in last week's video about the absolute collapse of the political centre and the mainstream political parties who have dominated politics in Europe for the last, you know, 100, 200 years. Basically, all of them are collapsing. And this is very relevant in the context of the Restless Politics podcast, because the whole idea of the Restless Politics podcast is it is based on the idea of two-party politics, which is we have the Labour Party, the traditional centre-left party, and the Conservative Party, the traditional centre-right party. These guys are on opposite sides of the coin. And, you know, if we have these two guys, then we can see things from two different angles. But the fact is, both of these political parties are absolutely collapsing in power and popularity. And that is happening not just here in the UK, but it is happening across the entire world. And I think people like Rory Stewart and people like Alistair Campbell, if they had their eyes open, they would be looking at that. They should be saying, why are not just our political parties, UK Labour and UK Conservatives, collapsing in popularity, but why are all global centrist parties collapsing in popularity? I think it's you don't have to take much distance to look at the world and say something is wrong. And I think this response of Rory Stewart to say, you, Zach Polanski, you know, and also me, I went on the podcast and I was mentioned, Gary Stevenson, you want change, but is there a consensus from academics like me that things should change? You can't help but be reminded of this famous Marie Antoinette quote, let them eat cake. You know, it's incredibly obvious to anyone who's watching that that way of seeing politics and that way of doing economics is dying. And yet when somebody new comes in and says, let's do things different, you turn around and say, oh, but where's the academic consensus? Well, the setup of economics is, it is very unlikely that anybody who is very good at economics from a poor background is going to stay. There's very strong mechanisms. Take somebody like me, you know, top of my class at LSE, but from a poor background, I can't realistically afford to become an academic when houses in London, your flat in London costs 500, 600 grand. You know, I'm choosing a life of poverty. And then the end result is the vast majority of people in academic economics are people like Rory Stewart whose dads have got blue underlined names on Wikipedia, right? Because they are the guys who can afford to do it. So basically you're turning around and saying, listen, I am only going to even countenance change if it is accepted by the elite class. But when you have an economic crisis of inequality, that actively enriches the elite class. So you have this situation, you know, crises of inequality. We are not all getting poorer here. The last 20 years have not been bad for the top 1%. They've been fantastically good for the top 0.1%, and they've been okay for the top 5%. How many people are there with those PhDs in economics in the top universities who are not from the top 5%? What you are saying is, we will not accept any change on growing inequality unless it is mandated by the group of people who are benefiting from the increase in inequality. I think what we are seeing here is actually so, so interesting. And I don't think it's overplaying it to say that this is what we are witnessing, the death, really, of a form of intellectualism. So I think for me, for something to be a science or close to a science or a good field of study, it is incredibly important that ideas are open to challenge. And it is incredibly important that culturally powerful figures who are powerful in a discipline but are wrong are able to be challenged by people who are less well known and less powerful but are correct. If you do not have that in your science, then what you have is not a science anymore. It becomes essentially a dogma. You know, there's this story about calligraphy in medieval China. So calligraphy, obviously China has this, like Japan, this system of writing characters. You need to load thousands of characters. And apparently in medieval China, if you wanted to get an important job, you needed to memorize the perfect way to paint with a brush, like 10,000 Chinese characters. And what this meant was, basically, because it was incredibly expensive to educate somebody to learn over many, many years how to paint these 10,000 characters perfectly, nobody could enter the intelligentsia who was not from a rich family, because nobody could afford the education that was essential to be in that world. And what you are seeing here with this Rory Stewart gatekeeping of the word economist is basically that exact thing, which is you are not allowed to question the knowledge of my people unless you are one of my people. And this is incredibly frustrating because economics in particular is not a physical science. It does not have experiments. So obviously, I have a thesis here, which is that living standards are falling because of inequality. And I wrote my first video in June 2020 saying living standards will fall, inflation will rise, house prices will rise, stock prices will rise, the gold price will rise, you'll get government austerity, you'll get an inflation crisis. On the back of this thesis, and a lot of people, you know, that looks in hindsight like it was good, but you will have some economists that will say, no, you know, you're wrong. It wasn't to do with the increase of inequality. It was, you know, because of different things. It was because of maybe the Ukraine war. I'm sure people will say now it was because of the Iran war. There's no way for us to run the clock backwards and do an experiment where we say, imagine we had COVID again, but we didn't significantly increase the government deficit. We didn't significantly increase inequality. We funded things like lockdown by taxing rich people. Would you still see the same level of inflation? There's no way for us to run that experiment. So there's no way for us to say categorically Gary was right, and there's no way for them to say categorically Gary was wrong, because we can't do a physical experiment on it. Obviously, you can look at some cases like Switzerland. They didn't run the massive government deficit. They didn't get the inflation. But the fact is, we can't run an experiment. And this is why, for me, prediction of the future is so important, specifically in economics. Because if we have a situation where we cannot run experiments to see whose ideas are right and whose ideas are wrong, we need a way to get a sense of who has a correct understanding of what is happening in our economy. Otherwise, when we end up in situations like we are in now, when living standards fall for a long period of time, for 20 years, in what seems to be an accelerating way, and living standards will probably continue to fall, we will be unable to recognize who are the economists we should listen to when we are considering how to fix it. The private sector, trading, has this very aggressive way of deciding who to listen to, which is you simply look for people who have consistent track records of correctly predicting things that nobody else predicted at the time. So this is why when I wrote my first articles, when I wrote my first videos, and even now today, I consistently, as often as I can, try to make clear predictions about the future and try to make it clear that these predictions are not consensus at the time. And it's also why I try to make a number of different predictions. You know, when I came out at the beginning of COVID, I didn't just say there's going to be a cost of living crisis. I said it will be paired with increasing house prices and increasing stock prices and increasing gold prices. You know, this is, and increase in inflation. You know, this is an unexpected combination of things to happen. But none of those things were consensus predictions at the time. I think when you come out and you correctly predict a lot of things at once that nobody's predicting at the time, you know, after doing the same thing in the aftermath of 2008, that gives you a right to challenge an elite establishment that is consistently predicting things wrong. But what Rory Stewart is saying here is, in my opinion, like really fundamentally anti-scientific, which is to say we should not listen to people who have a long-term track record of being right when they are competing against people who have a long-term track record of being wrong, if they are in the field of work rather than in the field of academia. And it's incredibly frustrating for me. You know, this, when I was at school, I was very good at English as well as maths. And when I was young, I was sort of choosing, am I going to do like English and law, or am I going to do like maths and then try to get into finance? And at the end of the day, the reason I chose maths is because I got a D in my one exam, my William Blake exam, A-level English Literature. And it made me realise, like, I'm never putting my future in the hands of, like, the subjective analysis of some posh person again, basically. And in maths, I'm really confident. You give me the question, I'll put you the right answer. And in trading is the same. You know, I'm really confident my predictions will be correct. And that is why I've chosen these fields where the judgment is largely objective rather than subjective. Yeah, was the prediction right? Is the answer right? But it's incredibly frustrating to continually generate these predictions which can be seen afterwards to be correct, can be seen afterwards to be much better than the mainstream, and can be seen afterwards to be predicting that living standards will get worse for the masses and better for the elites, and then to be told by incredibly rich people, we are not going to listen to you because the elites don't agree. Yeah, it's incredibly frustrating. And I think this is really the heart of where the wealth tax argument is at the moment. And when establishment figures from established political parties like Labour, like Rory Stewart, turn around to new figures who are saying we're going to do something to change, like Zach Polanski, and say, you are an idiot, the public are going to rightly be off, because the public are going to say, well, what is your plan for change? I think until and unless the political centre, be that centre-right or centre-left, Conservatives, Labour, Democrats, Republicans, whoever it is in your country, until these central political parties have some sort of realistic, meaningful plan for how they are going to change the management of the economy so it stops delivering consistently falling living standards, every time they turn around to somebody like Zach Polanski or somebody like me and says, we're not listening to you, you know, because you're an idiot, the public are going to see that and say, well, what the f*** is your plan then? And I think it's only going to make Zach Polanski more popular. Yeah, and I think Zach Polanski's done this incredibly intelligent thing of he continually reposts all the attacks on him. And what he's saying is, listen, these guys are driving you off the cliff and all they're doing is calling me an idiot, you know. Who, whether you like Zach Polanski or not, Rory Stewart or anyone else in Labour or the Conservatives, you need to have a credible plan for change. All right, so that is the last thing. Now we move on to our final point, which is what do we do about this? Because the first thing to recognise is they're only attacking people like Zach Polanski and people like me because we are in an incredibly, incredibly strong position. The centre is collapsing. The far right is quite weak at the moment. At the moment, I don't really see any other group or any other idea which is like gaining momentum at the speed with which we are gaining momentum. I think you should support people like Zach and anyone in your country who is pushing for wealth taxes. You know, in Australia and New Zealand, that's the Greens, but it's different people in different countries. You know, whatever, Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren in the US, support the people who are doing the work. You know, I think when I look at Zach Polanski, I'm someone who's done media campaigns and has gotten attacked in the press. And I just want to say, like, it's hard and it's annoying, and it's having people just like attacking you and calling you a d- and, you know, people come exactly the way he looks, and, you know, it's just stupid nonsense stuff. And I just want to say, like, well done to that guy for keeping on going. And, you know, whatever you think about his other policies, in my opinion, if what you care about is the economy, in our current situation, while there is only one political party that's supporting wealth taxes, you do need to support this guy who's going out there and getting thrown at him every day. But we also need to build that academic credibility. Because I think at the moment, the reason that The Rest Is Politics and Rory Stewart have been able to, in my opinion, kind of slander the wealth tax with this idea that the main two proponents of the wealth tax in this country, me and Zach Polanski, are idiots, are not serious. That is only possible, in my opinion, because of classism. I don't think there is any reading of my professional and academic history that says anything other than this guy is a serious expert on inequality. But he's able to do that because, you know, he looks and sounds like what smart people are supposed to look and sound like in this country, and I look and sound like this. So we do need, especially in a country like the UK, which has a long history of classism, we need academics. So I have reached out to, in my opinion, the best guy in the world in terms of academics who is doing this, which is a guy called Gabriel Zucman, who is an incredibly prestigious French economist who has been doing work on inequality for a long time. He has been really pushing wealth taxes in France. He's been doing fantastic work. I've been in touch with Gabriel Zucman since, I think, 2014 was the first time I spoke to him. These guys, Piketty and Zucman and Sayers, they are like the world leaders on inequality. And I think what we really need, and I'm going to hope that they support us on this, is we need, where there are academics who look and sound like academics, we need them to help people like me and Zach, who are much stronger on social media but don't look and sound like academics. We need them to come and just make it like painfully obvious what is true, which is that a lot of serious academic economists support this idea. So we've reached out to him. He's accepted an interview. We're going to have him on in May. I think I will reach out to Thomas Piketty as well. And we're just going to show the British public and the global public that this is, that academics believe this. We can't allow this basically libelous slander that academics don't believe this, because academics do believe this. We're going to get them on the channel. But I think it's also important that we do not allow ourselves to be like battered into this lane that unless the academics say it's correct, that it's not going to be correct. So, you know, I've done loads of videos on the problems of academic economics. We'll flash them up now. There's one called The World of Economics. The best one is probably Why Economists Are Always Wrong. I think there's one called Why Your Economists Suck. I've done it loads. This one, Why Your Economists Are Always Wrong, is me walking around Oxford. So if you want, a bit of ASMR in the background for you. Academic economics is in a position where it basically doesn't look at inequality, which means that the vast majority of professors who have been doing macroeconomics for 20 years have no knowledge on inequality, have no serious knowledge of inequality, which means that they have a very strong vested interest in believing and putting out the idea that the problem is not inequality. Because if the problem is inequality, then they have nothing really to say about the problem. So the truth is, you know, we are going to keep getting pushback from economists, and the economists are by and large wrong. So I don't think we can accept this idea that until there is a broad economic consensus, something, you know, nothing should be done. We do need to also keep building up this other channel, which I think we are building. So I think at the moment, like, there's kind of, I think, a few different angles of attack we can use, right? One of them is political parties. And I said last week, you know, join a political party, whether it's Greens, whether it's Labour, you know, I said last week, and I still stand by it, even if it's reform, I don't care. Join your political parties and get them to do something about wealth taxes. If nobody's doing something about wealth taxes, support the political party that is doing it, which is Zach Polanski and the Greens. Sign up to vote. We did the big sign up to vote last week. We'll flash it up again. This is where you sign up to vote. We'll put it in the description. Sign up to vote, because we need to pressure them. We need more academics. But also, I think the real good angle of attack, and I think where we have made so much progress, obviously I would say this, but I do think it is true, the real big angle of attack here is social media. I think the reason that this has become such a big issue is largely because of the enormous success we have had here in bringing this issue to the public. And I want to talk a little bit, just briefly, about the importance of social media. So there's this idea that I've been putting around recently. You guys don't see this work. In the background, I'm doing a lot of lobbying of people to try to get them to be more serious about social media, because in my opinion, it is really obvious that political power is moving, has been moving, will continue to move away from traditional media like newspapers and TV and radio and towards social media. And that means that whichever sort of political ideas are big on social media will have a really good chance of getting enacted. We're changing policy here. We haven't done it in the UK yet, but we are changing it across the world, right? Because of this enormous pressure that we're pushing on social media. So I think the optimal model for politics in social media is what I've been calling the WWF model. WWF, which is now called WWE, is American wrestling. And you go onto American wrestling and there's like, you know, when I was a kid, sort of 10, 15, 20, now it's probably 30, 40, 50, like faces. Like all these different characters, like, you know, big characters. And, you know, these guys are a little group and these guys hate these guys and these guys are together and those guys don't like these guys. And I think that is a really, really powerful model for politics on social media, which is basically you have all these different people doing all these different things. And then when people come in and look at social media, they think, oh, wow, what an exciting space with all these different people in it. And I think the only real group of people who have succeeded in creating that kind of like social media product, which is full of all these different characters, is the US alt-right, far-right, whatever you want to call them. And I think that is a big part of the reason for the growth of the alt-right and the far-right across the world, especially amongst young men, because basically they've created this like social and exciting social media product. And I think, to be honest, if you want to be serious about like stopping the global growth of the far right, we do need to create a social media product which is focused on wealth taxes and inequality, which is similar in this same way. So really, I think here on this channel, I think what we need to do is to be honest, there's lots we need to do. We need to build out. We need to be better connected. We need to be able to support new like influencers who are coming up so that we can build new faces and names. And that's why I've been like so keen on trying to like support and keep mentioning people like Louisa Munch and Barry's Economics and Anna Bocca and Jimmy the Giant. Like I really want to support these names because I think in the absence of like a powerful political force and, you know, giving all the credit that is due to the work that Zach Polanski has done in the massive growth of the Greens, if Labour don't move, which it seems like they're not going to move, we need to create a space which is so big that basically when the new Labour leader comes in, they've got no choice to move. But we also need to be better linked up, better connected. We need better connections to politicians. One of the reasons why I've been travelling the world is to try to like find good people in different countries who are also pushing this. You know, I've been really happy to meet Chloe Swarbrick in New Zealand. She's doing great work. But basically, we need to build this. We need to be better connected. We need to be better connected to politicians. We need to be better lobbyists. And if I'm going to be totally honest, we need on this channel to be better funded. It is largely me and my mate Oscar trying to run around, do everything around this YouTube channel. Yeah, I think if we want this to be bigger, we need staff. We need staff, which is why we're going to move on. We are going to move on to a pitch to the Patreon, I think. I think if you want to be serious, you know, you don't have to give money to the channel. There's loads of things you can do. You can create your own stuff. You can support the videos. You can push it. But I think if we want to make this a movement, we do need, really what we need is a lobbyist, to be honest. Because we're sitting here, we're going to grow the channel as much as we can. But where we have really failed is in linking ourselves up to like other groups internationally, other groups in this country, and in building good connections with the political parties. Hopefully we'll get some growth off of the documentary, which will come out later this year. But I think that's what we need to do. We need to lobby better. We need to be better connected. We need to grow this channel, and we need to grow other channels. But it is getting to the point, really, where I can't do that, and we do need staff. We're gonna put the Patreon up. The Patreon is set up as a not-for-profit company, so none of the money goes to me, none of the money can possibly go to me. It all goes towards hiring staff. And it would be nice to build something a little bit more serious here so that we can win this, I think. Centre's dying. The far right is weak. The future is there to be won. The future is there to be won. So that's the end of the Patreon pitch. I have to do that at least once a season because otherwise we can't afford to make these videos anymore. But that's it, basically. Last thing I want to say is, honestly, this is not a joke. This is deadly serious. I have got a lot of respect for Rory Stewart, honestly. I love this book. I thought it was the only reason I don't have his book to show you is because I lent it to my mate because I thought it was so good, Politics on the Edge. It's hilarious, really, to be honest. And he really supported my book. You know, I think this is not me advertising it. I don't know if you see this. On the quote on the front of my book is, can you get that?
Is Rory Stewart, because he gave a great quote.
And look, I don't think he's a bad guy. I just think he's, I actually think he's super interesting. I think he's a great writer. I think it's so interesting that he like somehow like forgot that I had a postgraduate degree. And I think it really tells you so much about how he needs to create a narrative that him and his guys are not the bad guys and the status quo is not bad. And, you know, that's normal. You know, it's normal for people to be scared and it's normal for him to be scared and it's normal for him to be challenged. And, you know, Rory Stewart, you are, you know, I loved your book. You know, I enjoyed coming on your channel. You're more than welcome if you want to come here and discuss anything we've said today. You know, yeah, okay, we'll have you on any time. I think you're a really interesting guy. But look, what you are seeing here is more and more every day, it's a political vacuum, right? The centre is crumbling. The world is there to be won. I think there's so much opportunity. And what I'm going to really try to do this season, as much as I can, as much as my sort of energy and mental health allow, try to help build up these other influencers. Try to be better connected. But yeah, look, support us. Register to vote. Be ready to push. And just stay cool. Don't stress out, because which is something that I've probably failed to do in this video. Yeah, we're going to be here. Sorry for doing so many long videos recently, but there was just so much crazy stuff to catch up on. Hopefully next week will be shorter. But yeah, thank you very much for your time. Tax wealth, not work. And sign up to vote.